what I want to say is a real challenge to squeeze into the time that I might have to say it in. And there are other times when it's just a simple thought, but I think it's important. And so I want to dwell on it at some length. This is one of those. This won't be a complicated presentation. It won't be long. Unless I do a lot of ad-libbing, I may not even make it to 12 o'clock. But I do think it's important. So I'd ask you to bow your heads as we begin. Father, I pray that you'll be with us this morning, that you would guide our thoughts and grant us a practical blessing. In Jesus' name, amen. My sense is that we don't talk about heroes, we don't use the term hero as much as, say, maybe back a few decades before I was born. I'm thinking 30s and 40s. You go back, you look at the literature, the dime store novels of the 1910s, 20s, there's a lot of hero stuff going on. And, you know, the words kind of fallen into some disuse. But I want to kind of resurrect the idea. A worthy hero, yes or no? It's a question for you to decide. Well, let's see. Who is a hero? How do you know a hero when you see one? Sometimes we use the term as a kind of an external adjective, so to speak. Oh, Marvin's a hero. Okay. But that's not really what I'm after. What I'm after is my hero or your hero. And that requires, in order to, you know, say that someone is my hero or your hero, that requires something going on in my head or your head. It's not totally dependent on what the other guy did. So I'm going to throw out some ideas. I hope I'm reasonably on target. You may choose to view it slightly differently, of course. That's your prerogative. But I'm going to say that a hero, at the core, is someone you want to be like. You may respect people. You may appreciate them. You may think they're talented or something. But they're not a hero if you don't actually want to be like them. That's the kind of the definition I'm working with. Now maybe you view that differently. But bear with me. So you look around today and let's just ask, who today do people want to be like? We don't use the term hero so much, but there's still the concept or the things out there, let's put it that way. Who do people want to be like? And I'm going to suggest that one of the more obvious examples are any number of various different professional athletes. Somebody is, I suppose, arguably the best at whatever particular thing or game or whatever that they are involved with. And it seems like there's a lot of young men, especially, who invest a fair amount of time trying to be like this particular basketball player or that particular football player or something. You know, this guy can do this particular super duper 360 twist slam dunk something or other, blah blah blah, you know, and so that's what I want to do, you know, which is why I have to go out and pay $320 for a pair of basketball shoes, because it's going to make it so I can do that, I suppose. But anyhow, that's a different topic. But we spend a lot of time trying to, collectively as a culture, let's put it that way, a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to be like professional athletes. Perhaps in a category which I'm going to guess may appeal slightly more to the females. Guys too, but maybe a little bit more to the females, would be musicians. Musicians are I think, kind of heroes. Get a lot of people who, oh, I want to be like what's her name, or who's his face, or whatever. Trust me, if I went down that route, I would just indicate how much I don't know about it. But anyhow, another category is actors, actresses. I don't think quite so much. I don't think your average kid on the street wanders around thinking, oh, I want to be like so-and-so actor as commonly as maybe I want to be like so-and-so basketball player or so-and-so musician or something. I think maybe it's more, oh, did you see this character in such and such a movie? You know, and we don't even care that the character is entirely fictitious and, you know, whatnot, but oh yeah, the guy, when he did that thing, that was so cool, that's what I want to be like, possibly. Pardon the judgmentalism, but I think those who desire to be like actors and actresses may want to check the depth of their thinking. Actors and actresses hardly ever know what they're like in the first place, because what they're paid to do is to be like somebody else, so whatever. Probably those with absolutely no sense of reality, I fear, because they're actually blinded by selfishness. The last category, the one that people want to be like, is the one who actually has no discernible skill whatsoever other than the fact that they are a celebrity. What in the world is that? Can't sing, can't dance, can't act, can't shoot a basketball, can't kick a football, but they're still on the front page of all these stupid magazines. I mean, what's up with that? All they know how to do is get themselves on the front page of a magazine. Fine. Okay. A lot of people hold these kind of characters as their heroes. Seems to me. I don't have any scientific data to back that assertion up, but I'm just going to go ahead and assert it. Seems like there's a lot of people do. Sometimes someone has a hero of more substance, thankfully. And, you know, army general, terrorist leader. There's a lot of people that are, you know, what's his name? Bin Laden was a hero to a lot of people, you know. Maybe a lawyer, politician, social, environmental activist, some sort of a computer hacker, you know, what's this guy, Assange, whatever the guy's name, you know who I'm talking about. The guy with WikiLeaks, he's a hero to a lot of people. Business executives, doctors, scientists, humanitarians, maybe some missionaries are heroes, whatever, you know. They can be heroes. If somebody wants to be like them, I'm going to call them that person's hero. So, who's a hero? Someone you want to be like, Maybe another way of saying that would be someone you follow as a leader, perhaps. Biblically, there are lots of examples that we might look at along these lines. Various of the judges, you know, you read through the book of Judges, and Gideon rose up, you know, delivered Israel, and Barak rose up and delivered Israel, and so-and-so rose up and delivered it. And you get the impression that, you know, people followed them. They were leaders. And I suspect that at least some of the folks who were following them said, man, that's pretty cool. That's the kind of guy I want to be. David, be an example. Solomon, probably. At least he had the advantage of being rich. You know, a lot of people want to be like the guy who's rich. Maybe some of the other kings. One of the more interesting examples is Elijah and Elisha. Let's go to 1 Kings 19 here. I'm just kind of picking up in the middle of a thought. This is 1 Kings 19, 19 to 21, as I'll be quoting, if you want to turn and see the context of that. It says, Elijah found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, please, let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I'll follow you. And Elijah said to him, go back again, for what have I done to you? So Elisha turned back from him, took a yoke of oxen, slaughtered them, and boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment, and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. Now, that's just an interesting passage. You get the impression it's like Elijah's walking past and he throws this mantle on him and just keeps hiking down the road, you know. And it's like Elisha has 20 seconds to make up his mind or something. But unless they were a lot more technologically advanced than I think they were, you can't really slaughter an ox and boil it in 20 seconds. I mean, that had to be a bit of a project. So it looks like Elijah was willing to wait a bit. It's kind of interesting. Well, think of the context of this. What had just happened back in chapter 18? Why would Elijah have been in a position to just come along and throw a mantle on some guy and for him to say, up, oh, I'll follow you? What happened in chapter 18? What's that? Mount Carmel, yeah. Elijah was a pretty impressive guy. You know, calls down fire from heaven, single-handedly executes 850 false prophets. That's impressive. Another interesting story is the story of Timothy. In Acts chapter 14, Paul came to the town of Lystra, which just happened to be Timothy's hometown. And in the process of events, Paul healed. Jesus healed, but, you know, Paul was the human agent. Healed this fellow who'd been crippled from birth. Got a lot of attention. But then it kind of almost backfired, so to speak, and the people of Lystra turned against Paul, and they stoned him, drug him outside of town, and dumped his body alongside the highway because they figured he was dead. That was Timothy's introduction to Paul. That's the first time Timothy saw Paul. But a couple of chapters later, Paul comes back to Lystra. And he says, I want to take Timothy with me. I'm going to go on a missionary journey. And Timothy went. which is kind of impressive. You know, it's like, wow, last time I saw this guy, he was lying by the road. We all thought he was dead. I think Timothy had seen something in Paul that you could say made him a hero. Well, who's a hero? Try another metric, another way of kind of measuring this. How about this one? Someone you talk about. If you never talk about the guy, he's probably not your hero. It's not hard to find a biblical example here, right? Therefore, those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. But just talking about someone doesn't necessarily make them a hero. We talk about a lot of people. Sometimes the people we talk about are not our heroes, and you can tell by the way we talk about them. That's another story. So just talking about someone may not qualify as a hero, but if you don't talk about them, they're probably not your hero. But I'm going to go back to an idea we had before. If you talk about them because you want to be like them, I think they qualify as your hero. So here's a question. Who do you talk about? Who do you talk about? Do you have a hero? Do you talk about him or her? Well, okay, this is church. This is a sermon, so you'd expect it to get around to Jesus at some point. Is Jesus a hero? Well, he was for Paul, right? The classic example, 1 Corinthians. And I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God, for I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. This was right after Paul's experience in the Areopagus, the Mars Hill in Athens, where he had met philosophy with philosophy. It's fascinating stuff. Some great history behind the philosophy that Paul used. You know, the monument to the unknown God. Great history behind that. It's a real, there's actual case history behind that. It's fascinating stuff. But that's another story. But he tried the philosophical approach in Athens, and it really hadn't been that particularly successful. So he moved on to Corinth, and he says, you know what? Simplify. I'm just going to talk about Jesus. That's all I'm going to talk about. So, probably we all have the idea that at some level or another, Jesus ought to be a hero. We probably all have the idea that at some level or another, he ought to be our hero. So let's go here for a little while. What's Jesus like? You know, I mean, people are heroes because of what they are, nobody inherits hero status, do they? I mean, I suppose a king might come as close as anything or something, I don't know, but you know. I don't think so. I don't think you can inherit hero status. It's what you're actually like. So what's Jesus like? And probably, if you're like most people, first thing that comes to mind is that Jesus is loving. Good. Keep working on it a little bit. You might come up with Jesus is kind. Good. A little more effort. Jesus is compassionate. Is that it? Is that all he was? Is that all he is? Well, you know, if you work a little bit harder, you can come up with more adjectives. We could come up with caring, generous, unselfish, benevolent, and gracious. Okay. But that's nothing but a bunch of names for the same thing. Is that really all there is to Jesus? This may be a real issue if that's all we can think of. Because some of us may have a problem with that list. What if I don't find loving, kind, compassionate, caring, generous, unselfish, benevolent, and gracious all that exciting? What if it doesn't really turn my crank? Let's expand this list a little bit more. What is Jesus like? Well, he's got all that there. But let's flip kind of almost the other end of the spectrum, so to speak. How about this list? Healthy, strong, muscular, maybe even buff. Does anybody use that word anymore? It's like that word showed up. I still remember the first time I heard that teaching school, and I was trying to describe something about being strong and whatnot, and they said, buff. And I had never heard that term used in that way before. And I said, what is that? You know, it strikes me as one of those words that probably has about a 3-year life expectancy. So I'm guessing that nobody describes anybody as buff anymore. Is that right? Somebody tell me one way or the other? Probably not. I'm just behind times because, yeah, it's okay. You know, that list is interesting. Jesus walked several times back and forth between Jerusalem and Capernaum. Remember that? You know? And the high priests and the rabbis and everybody were trying to kill him in Jerusalem, so he left and he went to Capernaum. Sounds so simple. You know how far it is from Jerusalem to Capernaum? It's 120 miles. It's 120 miles. You can save 30 miles if you cut through Samaria, but as a Jew, you were liable to be killed, which Jesus did that anyhow. Remember the whole thing of going through Samaria? So maybe that brings us to the next list. He was also brave, determined, resolute, fearless, unshakable, and unwavering. He says, I'm going to go through Samaria. And I'm not really too worried if they try to kill me. Because he was all of those things. Maybe we could add steadfast, devoted, single-minded, persevering, self-controlled, and patient. All sorts of ways you could take those words. I kind of like this list. Decisive, authoritative, commanding, intimidating. Picture Jesus standing in the temple with a little handful of cords in his hands and everybody running. Because he's standing there and told them to get their stuff out of here. Take these things hence. And he said it with this commanding, authoritative, actually intimidating. You know? That's impressive. I could see that as hero material. I'm also kind of drawn to this list. Jesus was smart. He was perceptive. He was always one step ahead of the bad guys. He was tactical. He was well informed. I really like that list. And I think there's probably a lot of other things that could be added, but it's important that we pay attention to these. Here's my premise. It's important. Because if there really isn't anything about Jesus that I find admirable, if there's nothing there that I can look at and honestly say, that's what I want to be like, then I really don't believe, and you may think this is kind of hard line, but just hear me out. If there's nothing in Jesus that I can admire enough to say, that's what I want to be like, I don't believe I have any business calling myself a Christian. End stop, period, point. It doesn't work. I might as well quit pretending to be one. You know, I remember the first time I actually saw anything in Christ that seemed genuinely desirable. I was raised an Adventist. I was raised a Christian. I was raised with the Bible stories. They're all good and fine and proper. But you know what? It's not that I was some particular heathen or anything. It's just they didn't turn my crank. I grew up with that stuff, and there wasn't anything there that was that particularly exciting to me. Hadn't point blank rejected it, just wasn't doing much for me. But I remember very distinctly, one day I happened to be reading in the book Desire of Ages, and for the very first time in my life that I remember, I saw something that made me say, man, that's cool, I want to be like that. Here's the passage. The next morning, the Sanhedrin again considered what course to pursue toward Jesus. 3 years before, they had demanded a sign of his messiahship. Since that time, he had wrought mighty works throughout the land. He had healed the sick, miraculously fed thousands of people, walked upon the waves, spoken peace to the troubled sea. He had repeatedly read the hearts of men as an open book. He had cast out demons and raised the dead. The rulers had before them the evidences of his messiahship. They now decided to demand no sign of his authority. What are we doing? Do this, and he does it. What do we do then? But they were going to draw out some admission or declaration by which he might be condemned. Repairing to the temple where he was teaching, they proceeded to question him. By what authority doest thou these things, and who gave thee this authority? They expected him to claim that his authority was from God. Such an assertion they intended to deny, but Jesus met them with a question, apparently pertaining to another subject, and he made his reply to them conditional on their answering this question. The baptism of John, he said, whence was it? From heaven or of men? The priests saw that they were in a dilemma from which no sophistry could extricate them. If they said that John's baptism was from heaven, their inconsistency would be made apparent. Christ would say, why have you not then believed on him? John had testified of Christ, behold, the Lamb of God which taketh away the sin of the world. If the priest believed John's testimony, how could they deny the messiahship of Christ? If they declared their real belief, that John's ministry was of men, they would bring upon themselves a storm of indignation, for the people believed John to be a prophet. With intense interest, the multitude awaited the decision. They knew that the priests had professed to accept the ministry of John, and they expected them to acknowledge him without a question that he was sent from God. But after conferring secretly together, the priests decided not to commit themselves. Hypocritically professing ignorance, they said, we cannot tell. Neither tell I you, said Christ, by what authority I do these things. Scribes, priests, and rulers were all silenced. Baffled and disappointed, they stood with lowering brows, not daring to press further questions upon Christ. By their cowardice and indecision, they had in a great measure forfeited the respect of the people, who now stood by, amused, to see these proud, self-righteous men defeated. Bam! Take that, bad guys! That turned my crank. I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, how smart was that? this guy's got it together. That's what I want to be like. Well, the problem, of course, is that I what I was thinking wasn't what Jesus was like at all. But it appealed to me. I didn't understand a lot of stuff. I just knew that here was a guy that was like so on top of things. That was pretty cool. My lack of understanding was a problem for another day. God's patient enough to cut idiots like me a little slack. But for the time being, for the first time in my life, I had seen something about Jesus that I could relate to. Something that actually attracted me. Now, I'm not the sharpest drawer in the knife. Or excuse me, knife, there you go. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. What can I say? Self-evident, I think, now. I'm not the, not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And it took a while before I noticed what the same book said two paragraphs down, which I conveniently ignored. It says, in his contest with the rabbis, it was not Christ's purpose to humiliate his opponents. He was not glad to see them in a hard place. He had an important lesson to teach. He had mortified his enemies by allowing them to be entangled in the net they had spread for him. Their acknowledged ignorance in regard to the character of John's baptism gave him an opportunity to speak, and he improved the opportunity by presenting before them their real position, adding another warning to the many already given. Now, whereas Christ's wisdom appealed to me as a way to slam these guys to the mat, he was actually trying to save their souls. Now, you know, some people might have been attracted to that part right off, but it didn't click with me. It was pretty easy for me to fluff that off. I wasn't too worried about that. Jesus could do whatever he wanted, I suppose. It's, you know. But the important thing is that I had found out that he had a black belt in verbal karate. And that's what I wanted. I actually set out to read several chapters in Desire of Ages just specifically with that thought in mind, trying to figure out, how did this guy do this? Eventually, I woke up and started noticing the other comments in the book, things like this one. This is in the setting of the triumphal entry, right? Lots of excitement going on, and says the calm voice of Jesus hushed for a moment the clamorous throng as he again declared that he had not come to establish a temporal rule. He should soon ascend to his Father, and his accusers would see him no more until he should come again in glory. Then, too late for their salvation, they would acknowledge him. These words Jesus spoke with sadness and with singular power. The Roman officers were silenced and subdued. Their hearts, though strangers to divine influence, were moved as they had never been moved before. In the calm, solemn face of Jesus, they read love, benevolence, and quiet dignity. Now, love and benevolence and quiet dignity were not necessarily the things that attracted me. I kind of liked the black belt routine. But it eventually began to dawn on me that the only reason Jesus got away with the black belt was because of the love, benevolence, and quiet dignity. Notice what happened. This is the Roman soldiers who see love, benevolence, and quiet dignity in his, face or voice or whatever it was, calm, solemn face, okay? Paragraph goes on. It says, the Roman soldiers, were stirred by a sympathy they could not understand. Instead of arresting Jesus, they were more inclined to pay him homage. Turning upon the priests and rulers, they charged them with creating the disturbance. These leaders, chagrined and defeated, turned to the people with their complaints and disputed angrily among themselves. Well, yeah, they just got slammed to the mat again. But only because of love, benevolence, and quiet dignity in the calm face of Jesus. another statement says about the same thing about the people standing around when Jesus was issuing the woes on the Pharisees. You know, it's like, this was a lopsided deal, you know? Those religious leaders had a lot of influence. And Jesus was going right up against all of that. It's a tough job. Homeless carpenter takes on church and state officials. It was only because of the love Jesus had shown the people in the months before that they continued to respect him. And so, here, this brave, determined, whoa, you know, that stuff, that's what appealed to me. It wouldn't have worked without months of preparation by loving, kind service to these people. The people would have turned against him. They would have ripped him limb from limb. He's insulting the leaders of their country. Gradually, I learned something. It took a while. The question really was, how can I be like Jesus? I found out it's not by picking and choosing. It doesn't work to say, I just want to be smart like Jesus was, or I just want to be commanding like Jesus was. It doesn't even work to say, I just want to be loving like Jesus was. Because loving doesn't work any better without the other things, and the other things work without the love. Christ-likeness isn't a menu. Jesus gives us one offer. It's all or nothing. Because every part of his character depends on every other part. God has a plan, and even though it's all or nothing when it comes to serving the Lord, it isn't all or nothing in one big step. You know, if it was all or nothing in one big step, I never would have made it. The truth is that God won't make us smart, kind, loving, or any of those other things. He won't make us something we don't want to be. And even though we may say, you know, I want to be like Jesus, he isn't going to make us sweet, kind, and loving until we actually want to be sweet, kind, and loving to that rude guy next door. Follow what I'm saying? He puts the desire in our heart before he brings the change in the character. Nor will he make us wise, determined, or commanding when we don't want to be wise, determined, or commanding. He puts the desire in the heart before he changes the character. So, how can I be like Jesus? The simple verse. And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself. The way to appreciate all the various aspects of Christ's character is to get to know all the various aspects of Christ's character. And as long as there's at least one aspect that you find desirable enough to want to actually be like him. I go back again. If I look at Jesus and I don't see anything that makes me say, man, that's what I want to be like, I don't think I know him enough to claim the name Christian. But as long as there's one, as long as there's, you know, all I wanted to be, I wanted a verbal black belt. That's all I wanted. But I found out you can't get that by itself. It takes all the other stuff to make it work. It's kind of like saying, I don't want a whole car. I just want a gas pedal. Oh, great. You know, what are you going to do? Hang it on the wall? You know? It's not going to do you much good that way. So here's my two bits worth of advice. Deliberately hunt out the cause and effect interrelationships between what you do want of Christ's character and what maybe you don't want yet. There are interrelationships. And all the stuff that, you know, oh, I really ought to be this-a-way, but it just doesn't appeal spend a little time thinking about it. Say, you know what? I want to be this, but I don't want to be that. It just doesn't appeal, but what's the connection? There will be a connection, I'll guarantee it. Because Christ is one whole. Christ is not divided. Hunt out the cause and effect interrelationships between what you do want and what Jesus says you need, and pretty soon, you'll be wanting what you need. So, here's my final. Is Jesus a worthy hero? And then for each of us, is he your hero? It's a simple thought. But to me, it's been important. I hope it's a blessing to someone else. And that's it. So let's sing our closing hymn.